Hi, welcome to Info Dumpies. My name's Brianne. I'm autistic, I have ADHD, my pronouns are she, her, and y'all, I'm about to fucking lose it. Like, I'm gonna Hulk out and I'm gonna fucking lose it. That's a joke. I'm not about to lose it, but this solo dump, which is an episode that is sans Violet, but just me, is about autistic meltdowns. If you've not listened to a solo dump, that's an episode where I take the reins for an episode and I talk about a topic pertaining to autism or ADHD and being a person who lives with one or both. Quick content warning for this episode: when talking about meltdowns, it would be remiss of me not to talk about how often those come with feelings of shame and sometimes even suicidal ideation. So while I may not go into detail, I will be mentioning SI later in this episode, and if you are not in a place to hear that, please, you know, I'll catch you next time. Please take care of yourself and no hard feelings if this is not the episode for you. So this solo dump I've kind of formatted in a different way, and it's me talking about some of the most common questions I get asked by clients I see about meltdowns. If you have listened to the podcast and you're not aware, my day job is doing coaching and peer support for fellow ADHD people, so I get to talk to a lot of really great autistic people who also have to deal with meltdowns, and there are a lot of questions that I've run into that are common themes. I also dipped into the Discord server to see if anyone else there had things they either wanted to know about meltdowns or things that they wished non-autistic people in their lives understood about meltdowns as well. So first, what is an autistic meltdown? This question it's more important, I think, than it seems on the surface, because I think especially for a lot of us who are late recognized autistic people, we were having them the whole time, but I've noticed a very common theme where we get told that we're having panic attacks and also we have anger issues. When in actuality, if you look at descriptions of autistic meltdowns, we were just having like textbook autistic meltdowns. So what is an autistic meltdown is a very important question. Autistic meltdowns are a normal expression of the sympathetic nervous system in an autistic person. Doesn't mean they're fun. Doesn't mean you want to be having them all the time. But it doesn't mean you're broken. It means you're a normal autistic person, and this is something that sometimes your sympathetic nervous system kicks into this mode and we have to deal with and manage. An autistic meltdown is almost like your nervous system is letting an emergency release valve go, and your nervous system's trying to manage what is essentially cognitive overload. They can look explosive or violent, but these are not something the person is generally trying. It's not really rooted in being angry at one specific thing. Now, I will give the caveat that when someone doesn't know they're autistic and they're having meltdowns, and I say this from personal experience, sometimes when we have a meltdown, we will blame the most recent thing to contribute to our meltdown, and that can lead to some really unhealthy things. So I am a much, much, much better partner after learning about my autism, because I was kind of just someone who would explode at the most recent thing to contribute to my cognitive overload, and then afterwards not understand why my reaction to what seemed like such little stimulus was so huge. And I thought there was some moral failing of mine, but now understanding that I'm experiencing a neurological event and it's not, you know, James's fault because they were eating Swedish fish around me and I didn't have headphones on, I can be a much better partner and just a friend and person to be around in general. Some high masking autistic people may be able to suppress a meltdown when we're in an unsafe space, but the internal experience of a meltdown still occurs. So you might see this talked about as like swallowing a meltdown in the autistic community. It's very common phrasing for it, an internalized meltdown. But meltdowns can include screaming, crying, repeating the same phrases over and over, intense stimming, sometimes self-injurious stims, which I will get into how these are different from self-harm, hitting things and or people, and simply running away from the overwhelming situation sometimes, which can get referred to as autistic elopement. What is an autistic meltdown not? It is not an emotional outburst, even though emotions may contribute to it, and even though someone may be feeling a lot of big emotions while having one. This isn't just a lack of emotional regulation, it's all kinds of cognitive input have led you to this point. So they are not a tantrum. A tantrum has a goal. A tantrum is someone acting in that way in order to get something. And very often autistic people will be told that we're being manipulative with our meltdowns because people cannot understand the lived experience of behaving this way if it's not a tantrum. But I guarantee if an autistic person in your life is having a meltdown in front of you, God, that is the last thing they want to do. That is a state that for most autistic people I've spoken to, we feel a lot of shame when it's done. It's embarrassing. It is probably the smallest and worst and just most emotionally awful I feel on a regular basis is when I have a meltdown. So it is so much different than from a tantrum. Like, I don't have a goal other than I want my brain to stop feeling like it's on fire, which the internal experience of an autistic meltdown I very often described as someone set the inside of my brain on fire and I have been locked inside and I'm screaming, trying to escape, and I can't get out. It is a miserable feeling and is, I don't know, acutely painful is not like the right word, but it is such a level of discomfort. It's so hard to describe to someone who hasn't experienced it themselves. So you might be someone who didn't really have autistic meltdowns and started having them more once you realized you were autistic, which is really common. You might be someone who didn't know you were autistic, but started having autistic meltdowns a bunch, and that's why you were figuring out that you were autistic. And that's actually the thing that happened to me. And the way that it was put both by the person who assessed me for autism and my therapist was that sometimes when we have grown up in an unsafe environment, we're really used to swallowing those meltdowns and internalizing them. And when our nervous systems finally accept that we are in a safe space and we're safe to do what our nervous systems do naturally, it starts doing the thing it was kind of, you know, wired to do. So for me, I finally felt safe and comfortable, and the irony was that meant that I had to deal with these really gnarly meltdowns. So what does an autistic meltdown feel like? So I've briefly described the my brain is on fire part to me, but this is also going to be highly individual. People are going to have their own ways of wording it. My personal description, it feels like my brain is on fire. I lose control. Like, I'll start saying things I really wish I wasn't saying out loud. And very often it's those internal thoughts that I really, really never want anyone else to hear, but it's the negative self-talk that I'm trying to suppress a lot of the time. It could be my anxieties. It could just be a big scream, and I feel like I have very little power to stop it. Like, it takes so much energy to try to suppress it. And it really gets a lot harder once you learn you're having meltdowns, because when you think you're just dealing with what everyone else is dealing with, it's easier to suppress. But it's kind of like, and I've used this description before, it's like a big Truman Show reveal. Once you figure out what's really happening, it's almost impossible to pretend anymore. But I feel a loss of control, and I feel what I kind of describe as a directionless rage. And not everyone who has meltdowns feels the kind of ragey part. That's why it looks violent. But when you think about it as a function of your sympathetic nervous system and you think about fight or flight and cognitive overload being an actual threat to our autistic nervous systems, it kind of makes sense that these would look very anger-driven and, like, really activating. So before I knew it was autism, I would try to find a place to direct that rage. And that part, I believe, is our responsibility to understand that it's not your loved one's fault necessarily that you're having a meltdown. That's just your nervous system. So for me now, it doesn't get directed at anyone in particular, but it's just something I kind of have to write it out. Because meltdowns are from cognitive overload And that's not just sensory input, it's just any input added to our brains. Any extra information that's handed my way actively makes things worse. If you understand that autistic brains go through something like 75% less synaptic pruning than a non-autistic brain, when we're processing information, we are processing so much more and making so many more connections that that's one of the reasons it's so easy for us to hit cognitive overload. But it also means when you start asking me how you can help when I'm in the middle of a meltdown, that makes it way worse because, honest to God, when I'm having a meltdown, I have no access to, I think, my problem solving or higher brain functions. I just feel like I'm pure lizard brain mode, honestly, and have very little control or reasoning skills. So when someone's having a meltdown, asking them a bunch of open-ended questions is real rough. And for me, it just feels like I take psychic damage anytime anyone tries to offer me more information. When I'm having a meltdown, my sensory issues are multiplied times like 100. There are things that wouldn't bother me on most days that start to bother me. Things seem louder. All of that is just, again, more information I have to process. So I think sensory overload is the one that gets talked about it in regards to meltdowns quite a bit, because that's the thing that the holistic person can also kind of understand, if that makes sense. So I think that's why sensory overload is the one most commonly talked about, because I think that's something that non-autistic people can kind of conceptualize a little better because it is something that's very external. This is kind of where the content warning from the beginning comes in, but meltdown is when I experience SI the most. So suicidal ideation is really common with autistic people, and it's not us necessarily wanting to end our lives, but it's us wishing we didn't have to be alive while we feel this awful. So something I've talked to a lot of people about is that when we're feeling this way, especially when we've been having a lot of meltdowns, like for me, the little thought experiment of, well, would someone putting me in a safe medically induced coma until I don't feel like this anymore still scratch the same itch? And it's 99% of the time, yes. And that makes me understand. It's like, okay, I still very much want to be around, but I am in such agony after this meltdown that my brain is like, escape, escape, escape. I can't feel like this. This feels awful. So just reminding myself that that feeling is temporary and I will recover from it, and that my brain is just trying to manage these feelings. That it's a full body experience too. Like, head to toe, meltdowns are so exhausting. But if you're someone who is late recognized and you're like, I have panic attacks, except sometimes they kind of make me want to die. You might feel like you're dying when you have a panic attack, but the whole, I wish I didn't have to be around to experience this thing, is very much something that's common with autistic meltdowns. So, and anyone concerned, I'm safe, I'm fine. I just understand that when I have a meltdown, it's like, God, existing kind of sucks right now, doesn't it? This fucking blows. I hate feeling like this. So the next question is, what causes autistic meltdowns? So I've already given you the short answer, which is cognitive overload. The long answer? It's complicated. It's complicated, and because every autistic person has their own special array of autistic traits existing somewhere on their little sliders in our own character creator, you know, autism character creator, the things that trigger a meltdown in some people aren't going to be as likely to trigger them in others. So your mileage may vary with these, but some things can include sudden plan changes, routine interruption, prolonged or sudden sensory distress, autistic masking, being misunderstood. This is a big one. This one's very common. We're constantly misunderstood as autistic people. And being misunderstood when we've tried our very best to communicate clearly is such a big one. And I see this one with clients, especially in romantic relationships. So being misunderstood by your partner, especially, just anecdotally from my two cents, is a really big one I don't think people pay attention to quite enough. being given more demands we have to process, big emotions, either positive or negative. So for those of you who might be newer listeners, me and Violet and James are all from Texas, but moved to Minneapolis for our safety. And when we were trying to find a home in Minneapolis, it was really hard because a lot of people were doing the same thing as us. The market was really hard to find a place. But when we finally heard that we had gotten this house, and it was a house that is like 110 years old, which is kind of one of my dreams to live in a very old house, and it was well within our budget, shockingly, and that they had accepted our offer, I got so happy that I promptly had an autistic meltdown. So big emotions, regardless of whether they're positive or negative, can contribute to a meltdown. So this is why sometimes autistic people get really stressed when something might be very emotional, because we know that's so much to process that I know as a kid, I would get called like ungrateful or a brat. And I was just like, no, you don't understand. I really liked this Christmas present, or I really liked this birthday present. I just liked it so much, I couldn't handle it. So big emotions, positive or negative, they can lead to meltdowns. Ruminating on social situations we just had. So it's really common for autistic people to replay social situations in our head. And sometimes autistic rumination kicks in where we're kind of replaying it on our little simulator in our head a bunch. Gets extra gnarly when you also have OCD like me and you kind of get stuck in a loop. So ruminating on social stuff can do it. Too much socializing, even if it's stuff we've enjoyed, like I've had meltdowns the days after most concerts I've attended, and I've still very much wanted to attend those concerts. I just have to understand that my brain can't handle that much socializing and input. Watching or consuming some emotionally distressing media, especially if you're someone who experiences hyper-empathy. I'm on the low empathy end of things, so this is not something that usually happens to me, but I know several autistic people who really cannot watch or listen to something that's got a lot of big emotions going on when they're in a more heightened state. This is one of the reasons we tend to repeat TV shows and movies and stuff, because we already know what's coming and we already know what we can and can't handle. No time to transition between tasks. So very common for autistic kids to have issues at school because you have to go from one class to another pretty quickly. So having no time to transition between doing one thing and then mentally preparing yourself to do another thing can be a really big meltdown trigger. Physical pain. So that's sensory distress you can't really escape because it's happening in your own body. Physical illness, your body's feeling different than it usually does, can't really escape that. Being interrupted. So someone interrupting our hyperfocus when you have, I should do an episode on monotropism, but monotropism is a theory of autism that says that, it also includes ADHD, actually, about the way we focus, is that we focus on one or few things very intensely at a time rather than splitting our focus among several things. That's why we kind of suck at multitasking. But when something interrupts our focus, instead of being able to easily split our focus, our brains attempt to give 100% focus to the thing we were doing and the thing that's interrupted us, which I suck at math, but I don't think you can do 100% of your focus twice. I just don't think that's possible, right? So that can be really, really, really disruptive to be interrupted. And that's just a short list of things. Like I said, anything that adds to your cognitive load can contribute to a meltdown. So it's going to be highly individual. So for me, a lot of the times having plans changed and routines interrupted are really the culprit. And then being misunderstood. I hate being misunderstood. Socializing really takes it out of me, and I have to really be judicious about where I decide to spend my social battery. Like, I've had people say, you should network more for podcasting, you should cross promo with other podcasts. It's like, babe, either I start networking and spend all of my brain energy trying to converse with people who are not autistic and that I don't know, or I can make the podcast. I can do both. Like, I simply cannot. It's not going to happen. I can't. So social, like, overspending my social battery is a really big one for me. So the next question is, how is an autistic meltdown different from a panic attack? So it is really common, especially when you're a late recognized autistic person, that you get told that these are panic attacks. And it is totally normal for someone to experience both panic attacks and autistic meltdowns. For me personally, after learning what panic attacks were really like, which also told me that not a single mental health professional had ever listened to my descriptions of what they told me were panic attacks, because they were decidedly not what I was experiencing most of the time. I think I've only truly had like 2 panic attacks in my life, like 2 total in my 34 years of existence. So autistic meltdowns are quite different. So both feature feeling a loss of control, but most of how it appears and feels is quite different. Panic attacks are an acute and intense feeling of fear or impending doom. They're like anxiety is the thing that has consumed you. Both can feature feelings of depersonalization and derealization, both autistic meltdowns and panic attacks. So if you're a person that deals with both, it can kind of be hard to tell in the moment because, you know, if you're that disconnected from yourself, it's hard to tell. Very often when I have an autistic meltdown, it will feel like I'm watching myself do this stuff, and like, I will actively have this little part of me in my head saying like, oh, goddamn, you did a big scream. Oh, that's quite enough. You have to go record podcasts later and you just did a scream. That is not good for your vocal cords. I can't believe you dented the trash can again. I can't believe. So like, it kind of feels like I'm watching it, but I am powerless to stop it. So there are physical symptoms of a panic attack that are more fear-based also, which vary quite differently from what I feel during an autistic meltdown. They can include shortness of breath, racing heart, nausea, hot flashes, sweating, feeling faint. When I'm having an autistic meltdown, it's usually just this feeling of tenseness. It's this like really tense feeling, like my muscles have tensed up, which when you know, again, look at it as part of your sympathetic nervous system and your brain's hitting that fight button, it kind of makes sense that I feel tense. And it also feels like I'm fighting with my body to keep it from like hitting myself in the head or to keep it from clawing at my arms. And these self-injurious stims are things that I'm actively having to try to stop my body from doing. Like, my brain is trying to make my body do it, and I'm like, no, I don't actually want to do that. Which, the self-injurious stims part is not really a feature of a panic attack. So with autistic meltdowns, the feeling that really drives things is overwhelm and overload. So I used to just think I was easily overwhelmed, because my autistic meltdowns come with that irritability feeling. Before a meltdown comes for me, I usually just start feeling irritable, which is my first sign that I'm approaching one. With a panic attack, it's not so much like you start feeling bitchy, if that makes sense. With an autistic meltdown, there's simply a feeling of there being too much to process, too much to do. You might get stuck because you're trying to figure out how to do something and none of the options seem viable and you seem stuck. It feels like drowning in information and you can't get out. And that information could be from internal and or external sources. So very often, being a chronically ill human being, I have a lot of internal body stuff going on that makes it easy for me to get overloaded. It's a much different experience than a panic attack because, like, you know, having gastrointestinal distress may make you anxious at like what is causing it, but it's not going to make you have a panic attack if you know where it's coming from. So like for me, I got glutened last week and I have celiac disease, and woof, it was meltdown city because I just had this constant distress in my body that I couldn't escape from, and it was just contributing to my cognitive load. So with autistic meltdowns, it is not, so there's a bucket sort of metaphor that I did not come up with, and I have looked to try to find the originator of it, and I've done so unsuccessfully. So I'm going to use a bucket metaphor that I did not come up with, but I find very helpful. So imagine in your brain there is a bucket of how much input you can tolerate. An holistic person might have a couple of different buckets depending on the topic. They might have a social bucket, and then they might have like a physical body bucket where it's, you know, physical sensations, and a sensory bucket. And sure, when one of those buckets overflows, it might dip into their social bucket, so they're feeling yucky and they might get overwhelmed socially because they're feeling yucky. But for autistic people, we have one bucket. The volume of our bucket does not equal the volume of an holistic person's multiple buckets. We got one bucket, and that's where all of the cognitive input goes. It's not getting separated. And if you think about our synaptic pruning, it makes sense that all of this is way more connected for us. If I wake up, okay, and I had gotten glutened and my tummy feels like garbage, that adds to my bucket, right? It's poured some liquid into the bucket. And then if I wake up and I have a misunderstanding with Violet first thing in the morning, it's added to my bucket more. And then if I have a weird social thing happen with work, you've added to my bucket more. And then if my plans change and someone cancels plans they had with me later that day, that adds a whole bunch to my bucket. And then maybe, like, I don't have access to my same food, and that adds to my bucket. And then suddenly, James is eating Swedish fish, and I can hear them smacking on some Swedish fish. My bucket has overflowed. And it would look like my meltdown is such a dramatic response to someone eating Swedish fish while I happen to have misophonia. But really, my nervous system is reacting to all of the stuff that started filling my bucket from the start of the day. So when you have an autistic meltdown, you're not just overreacting, I'm using quotes, to the most recent thing that happened. A meltdown happens because you have been putting up with a bunch of cognitive input that was distressing and hard to process leading up to this. So it is something that builds on unrelated things that add to your cognitive load, and some small thing might trigger it. But the thing that made your bucket overflow doesn't bear the full responsibility for the contents of your, you know, metaphorical brain bucket. Panic attacks also don't usually include self-injurious stims in the same way that autistic meltdowns do. So self-injurious stims differ from self-harm because self-injurious stims are not something you're consciously choosing to do to cause pain to yourself. So this is not like I am deciding. So when I have meltdowns, the most common self-injurious stims that I experience are biting my arm or clawing at my arms or my legs or hitting my legs or hitting my head or hitting inanimate objects, and I don't want to do those things. If I were in control of my faculties, I would not be doing these things. I almost instantly, when the meltdown is over, feel so much shame and regret and like anger, honestly, because I didn't want to do those things and I lost control in a meltdown and I did. They're not things I'm consciously choosing to do. And when I'm in the middle of a meltdown, if I have not found easily accessible replacement stims that my brain has been able to like latch onto, it can be really hard to stop them. So I'm going to talk a little bit later about finding replacement stims to practice when you're not having a meltdown, so that hopefully your brain will be able to access those more easily with you not being in control when you're having a meltdown. The things that you practice when you're not having a meltdown are things that you'll more likely have access to when you are having one. And that's one of the best ways I found to curb these self-injurious stims. But they're not a choice. You're not choosing to do them. They're not something you're actively saying, ah, yes, this would be good. It's kind of like your brain is in so much pain that the usual stimming we do to try to regulate is not enough. And your brain's like, ooh, this sensation feels so bad. I'm going to need to like beat myself up to distract myself from it because that sucks less than how my brain currently feels. So if you're not autistic and you're like, why is my partner hitting themselves in the head when they get like this? It's not for manipulation. They don't want to hit themselves in the head. They don't want to be doing this. it just sucks to have their brain so much in that moment that their brain says, ah, this will make it feel better if I, you know, smack my head like a dad with a broken TV remote. It sucks. It is truly my least favorite part of the autistic experience. So if you have self-injurious stims, I know a lot of people are ashamed to talk about them. They suck, but I have them too. I have a bruise on my hand right now from a meltdown I had the other day where I bit my hand because I didn't have my replacement stim stuff handy. So it happens and it can be deeply embarrassing, but you are not alone. The next question is, how do I stop an autistic meltdown? I want to preface this by saying that if you are an autistic person who has meltdowns, you are never going to completely get rid of them. It is just something that you have to manage on top of everything else being an autistic person if you have a brain that, you know, clicks the meltdown button pretty easily. There are things you can do to try to stop them from, you know, fully happening when you recognize you're getting overloaded. There are regular practices you can do in your everyday life to try to help yourself manage things. But at one point or another, you'll have one again. And it sucks, but we can reduce how often they happen and we can try to make sure that we can recover from them when they do. So there's a term called rumble phase. The rumble phase is what happens before an autistic person is about to have a meltdown. And these are going to be highly individualized, but like I was saying earlier, one of my clues that I am starting to enter the rumble phase is I suddenly feel really irritable. So this is something that would happen to me a lot back when I would go out to eat. Restaurants suck so hard for my brain. I thought everyone was just dealing with it and that I got really bitchy at restaurants, but that was me entering the rumble phase before a meltdown. Or, you know, I'd randomly get really angry in the middle of a D&D game, and it's not anyone at the table who is necessarily making me upset. I was getting irritable because there were like 6 people talking at once and a bunch of people just playing with dice, and like all of the sound was way too much. And that, I didn't know back then, was my clue that I was entering the rumble phase. So random irritability is something that really works for me. It kind of starts snowballing from there. So there are certain stims that I know I am prone to when my brain is about to have a meltdown. So like for me, I know if I start making really tight fists and flexing my hands and making fists that I'm on the road to a meltdown. And when I notice those stims, it's like, oop, gotta remove myself from the situation before things get too bad. I start to depersonalize. I start staring off into space and zoning out, trying to, you know, my brain trying to rescue me from an uncomfortable situation. So recognizing what things are like leading up to when you have a meltdown can help you figure out what that rumble phase looks like. And when you start recognizing your rumble phase, you can start being proactive about helping your brain out as much as you can before you really and truly lose control. And after you've had one kind of debriefing with yourself and saying, okay, well, what did things look like leading up to there? You can kind of figure out what a rumble phase looks like for you. If you listen to my previous episode about a sensory diet, I've kind of changed some of the things I do with my sensory diet. But there is a concept of a reactive sensory diet that I still have for myself. And a sensory diet is essentially sensory input that is beneficial to you that you add into your day for your nervous system well-being. A reactive sensory diet is, what is your game plan when you are already overwhelmed and you need to recover? So for me, when I realize I'm in the rumble phase and I'm going to go remove myself from a situation, my reactive sensory diet plan is putting my headphones on, listening to something like rain or campfire sounds, getting under my weighted blanket, and covering my head with the weighted blanket also so I don't have to look at stuff. That helps me quite a bit if I can get access to that pretty easily, but having a game plan to help reduce input and help me regulate before things get too intense is the most helpful thing. So learning when you're in the rumble phase and then figuring out what helps you come down from that as far as sensory input is really, really vital. So the next question is, how do I prevent autistic meltdowns? Reducing your cognitive load is ultimately the thing. I know that's easier said than done. So for me, reducing cognitive load looks like limiting when I answer emails from clients, limiting my social media time, limiting how often I'm messaging friends on some of the apps, because always being accessible is kind of rough. It's, you know, utilizing my do not disturb quite a bit so I can get some alone time and reduce my cognitive load. It's trying to be aware of how full my metaphorical bucket is, and then deliberately trying to do things to either empty that metaphorical bucket a little bit or try to not add to it. So sometimes the best thing I can do is actually say no to some plans and say no to things, so I know that I am within my threshold of what I can handle while still being able to take care of my basic human needs. If you have listened to the sensory diet episode, you know about the concept of a proactive sensory diet. So a proactive sensory diet is basically the stuff you do for your sensory needs as an autistic person that help keep you regulated and prevent overload. You can go listen to that episode. It's changed since we've moved, and my schedule's changed and stuff, but one of the core things that's still the same for me is lifting weights is the cornerstone of my sensory diet. So I know online in the late recognized autistic community, a lot of people are like, rediscover your stims, but that doesn't feel natural to me. Like I don't naturally have a lot of outward stims that are that obvious. And I think when you're someone who's likely been traumatized out of those stims that felt natural to you, it's kind of a tall order to say, you know, well, just start hand flapping and see how you feel, because it might not feel natural anymore and you deserve relief. So for me, it turns out I had a lot of hobbies that were actually stimming, and leaning into those has been really good. So some of my favorites are crochet and hand sewing. And I lift weights every single day, well, 6 days a week, and the seventh day, it's real rough because I am more prone, after tracking my meltdowns, I am more prone to have them on my rest day. But lifting weights gives you a lot of proprioceptive and vestibular input, and I am very sensory seeking for proprioceptive input. So that's really helpful for me. So if you want to hear more about that and the different senses and different things you can do for yourself, I would go back and listen to that solo dump, because even though it's older, I still think it's got some really helpful information. Understanding your own triggers is a really big thing too. So like I said, understanding how full your bucket is involves you understanding the kind of things that add to your meltdown bucket. So for me, when I was gluten last week, I just knew that I was waking up with my bucket half full until my body recovered. I just understood that. And then acting accordingly with the more proactive sensory stuff to help me regulate, and trying to avoid triggers as much as humanly possible, which is not always humanly possible, but understanding what leads you to a meltdown is really important. Having regular alone time is actually really important, because being interrupted and not having time to ourselves can be really rough. So I have a code word with my partners. I don't know why it ended up in this fiction that I'm a professor and there are no office hours, but if I text them no office hours, they know that, okay, Brienne needs time to herself. She is not angry at anybody. She needs us to not text her. She needs us to not come in her room. She needs us to not try to come talk to her. If it's an emergency, you can come in or you can call on the phone and it'll bust through the do not disturb. But all in all, Brienne needs, the TLDR is no office hours means Brienne needs some alone time. Please don't interrupt her to the best of your ability. She is not angry. She will be out eventually. So that is something I recommend to clients a lot, is to have kind of a word that you and your partner or partners understand means, hey, I'm not mad at you. I just straight up need you to not be here for a little bit so I can regulate. So I regularly have times where I understand I'm not going to be interrupted, and my partners understand that also, and they understand that me doing that means they will get access to a much better and nicer Brianne when I get my prescribed alone time. Tracking your meltdowns, which I mentioned earlier, is another thing that can help prevent meltdowns. For me, I know if I don't get enough sleep, I am way more likely to have a meltdown. If it's one of my rest days from lifting, I am more likely to have a meltdown. If I am in physical pain and the closer it gets to my period, I am more likely to have a meltdown. These things are pretty individual, but something I also mention in a couple of solo dumps just because I like the app so much, but the How We Feel app, it's a free app that's main goal is to help with emotional intelligence. Tracking things and how we feel and how my feelings are and seeing how I feel after a meltdown and including some of the information about what my day was like really helped me figure out what some of my meltdown triggers were and what some of the best ways to prevent it were. So if you go back and listen to the solo dump about the sensory diet, I go into that with a little more detail, but it doesn't have to be the app. Like, you could just use pen and paper and say, I had a meltdown. This is what my day was like. And then just do that whenever you have a meltdown and collect some data, because we have great pattern recognition. And if we give ourselves enough data to pattern recognize what causes our meltdowns, that can be really helpful. You can also see what helps prevent them more by doing this. So that's why I learned that, you know, having time to lift weights and not feeling guilty about how much time I spend lifting weights is really important, because gosh, does my nervous system crave pumping iron. I have access to a much better version of my brain when I regularly get to lift. I think also just understanding that they're never going to go away completely is important. It might be easy to think that because you like swallowed these so long and internalized them so long that you just don't have to deal with them. But when someone internalizes or suppresses a meltdown, you still have all of those feelings you're dealing with. It's just going to take a lot longer to work through because you're not letting your nervous system to that release valve, right? Like, the pressure is not gone. You're just kind of, you've swallowed a bomb is what it feels like. And that's rough because there are some people who are not safe to have meltdowns in their current living environment. You know, one of my big fears is that I'll have a meltdown in public and I'll get involved in an involuntary psych hold, because that is something that could happen. If you are a BIPOC autistic person, it could mean losing your life, right? So understanding that you are prone to meltdowns and sometimes it is a matter of your safety, and that they won't completely go away, it's just an important reality to recognize for yourself. It sucks. Like, it's my least favorite part of being autistic, I'll be real with you. So how do I recover from an autistic meltdown? The reactive sensory diet is one that can be really helpful. Just having some sort of sensory retreat where you can, you know, listen to something you find comforting and be in a dark room. Like, I love my room to feel like a cave where I can just go hide and not have to listen to anything. I got sleep earbuds so I could actually comfortably lay down under the covers and cover my head when I need that sensory retreat. But something that's easy to access, something chill, something where you can just turn off all of the bad sensory input for a while, because that's the variable you can really control. Most of the time when I have sensory retreat after an autistic meltdown, time alone is also just really vital. Bonus points if you have a pet you love that you can have with you, but a lot of the time it's just me and Moogie in my room doing some really good snuggling and just chilling for a little bit. And that helps me recover. The next few days after a meltdown should also be pretty easy because your nervous system is not fully recovered and it's very easy to get put back into a meltdown again. So if you can reduce how much demands you have and things you need to do on the days after a meltdown, that can be really helpful. It's also a catch-22 though, because sometimes I'll have had a meltdown and I know that if I change my plans for the next couple of days, that will also overwhelm me, if that makes sense. So I kind of have to decide, it's like, okay, if not doing things tomorrow will help me, how would I feel if I canceled my plans? Oh, bad. Okay, I'm going to do the plans anyway. So sometimes it's the right choice, sometimes it's not, but reducing your demands for the next couple of days is generally pretty helpful. So the next question is, why have I been having so many more meltdowns than I usually do? So like I said earlier in the episode, you might be in a place where your nervous system actually feels safe to have them. One of the alternatives is that you might be an autistic burnout. So one of the biggest clues for me that I have approached autistic burnout and I'm on the precipice of it is that I start having meltdowns more regularly. For me, because I'm already prone to meltdowns, it can look like having them, you know, every day or every other day because my brain just can't handle anything anymore. My tolerance for things is so low. When I'm on autistic burnout, it feels like that meltdown bucket has been reduced by like 30 or 40%, and I have so much less that I can handle as far as cognitive load. So if you're having more meltdowns than usual, I would also consider that you might be an autistic burnout, which is actually something I need to do a solo dump about pretty soon. What can I do if I hurt myself during these meltdowns? I already went over the difference between self-injurious stims and self-harm, and the lack of intent with self-injurious stims makes it really tricky to try to find alternatives to those. But practicing replacement stims when you're not having a meltdown can make those more easily accessible. So like one of the things my body likes to do is to smack the shit out of my legs and my head. So I saw one autistic person in a forum somewhere who I wish I remembered them. Thank you, whoever you are, who recommended having a pillow that they can smack against their legs. So my brain still gets that same itch scratched of the hitting motion. I still get kind of uncomfortable input from that throw pillow hitting my legs, but I'm not actually hurting myself. My brain also likes to throw things, and I've also seen someone say that when they hit the rumble phase in a meltdown where their brain starts, you know, repeatedly being like, throw it, throw the thing, which my brain does too. I very often will just hand my phone to James or Violet because my brain is like, yeet the phone, eat it. But a replacement stim that some people find helpful is throwing ice cubes into the shower. So you're not going to hurt your shower. It's ice cubes. If they shatter, it's not the end of the world. It's an ice cube, but that also can scratch the same itch. With how I am prone to biting, I also have jewelry. So it's jewelry made to chew on. It's, you know, food grade silicone. And I have a few necklaces that if I've been having a lot of meltdowns lately, I will put one of those on. And when I do end up having a meltdown, my brain is like, ah, I can chew on this, instead of looking at my hand and saying, ah, I can chew on this. So finding things that kind of scratch the same itch when you're not having a meltdown can be really helpful. And you can practice those so that when you do have a meltdown, your brain goes, hey, you know what actually does that without hurting me? And that can be really helpful. Alternatively, if you live with people you feel safe around, sometimes a loved one can help you redirect or stop a self-injurious stim. This is something that your mileage may vary also, because when I'm having a meltdown, having someone grab me, like I'm not someone who often feels like a big hug helps. So for me, having someone grab my arms or anything is just, I think, adds for me, but a lot of people find it helpful to have a loved one help stop those stims. And your loved one can also do things like, if you talk about these things together, they can understand, this is the pillow that they use for, you know, squeezing instead of digging their nails into their hands, or let me get them some ice to throw at the shower. They might be able to help you redirect some of those self-injurious stims to something less harmful. So that segues into my final question, and that is, how can my loved ones help me during and after a meltdown? My number one tip is to kind of have a debriefing with your loved ones after you have a meltdown. If I have a meltdown, I usually talk to James and Violet afterwards about, you know, how it was feeling, how their attempts at helping me feel, and we can kind of figure out things to do next time together. Now, it's really hard because sometimes there is no, like, right thing to do during a meltdown. You just have to ride it out. So reminding your loved ones that it's like, hey, if I still am having a meltdown and it's still gnarly, it doesn't mean you have failed me. It just means I am disabled and my disability is disabling me and you've done your best. And the same things might not be helpful every time. So it seems discouraging when you are a loved one of someone who's autistic and you see them feeling so deeply, deeply pained and deeply uncomfortable in a meltdown. Sometimes there's just not a right thing to do, but you can help figure things out together to reduce the harm and figure out which things help most frequently, if that makes sense. Some people like really deep pressure, so their loved one can give them a really deep, like, deep pressure hug. Something that's really helpful for me is that if my partners want to ask me questions, they understand that a yes or no question is the most I can handle and that they have to keep it simple. I might not be able to say the words yes or no. I might be having a verbal shutdown or not be able to say anything within my control. I might be repeating the same thing. So I will squeeze their hands once for yes and twice for no. And they keep the question simple. They'll be like, can I bring you your headphones? Do you need me to leave? Because sometimes them leaving the room is the best. Code words for meltdowns can be helpful too. So sometimes it's hard for the non-autistic person to really understand when someone's about to have a meltdown. But you can have a code word and just say, hey, rutabaga, and your partner or loved one may understand, like, ah, rutabaga means that she is about to have a meltdown and she will be going to her room to be by herself. It doesn't mean she's mad at me. It means that things are snowballing and she needs to remove herself from the situation for the time being. It also helps if the loved one understands, like, this is not a way to try to get out of an uncomfortable situation. I genuinely cannot have a productive conversation with you right now, so I need to remove myself until I can. But code words, I'm a big fan of. I already talked about my code word for needing alone time, so that's pretty helpful for me personally. Loved ones reminding you that you don't have to be ashamed. And that's hard to internalize, but when you've grown up with people telling you that your meltdowns were a moral failing, having the people around you remind you that, hey, it's not your fault. You did what you could. Dan, that sucks that it happened, but I love you. That's really helpful for me, just to have people remind me that they don't hate me after a meltdown and they don't think I'm, like, evil for it, which sounds so grim, but I think anyone who has meltdowns can kind of understand where I'm coming from there. Sometimes it may look like watching a comfort show together. So, like, after I've had a meltdown, one of the things I usually turn on is, like, Buffy or Star Trek. Buffy and Star Trek are my go-tos after a meltdown. And if you find, you know, your loved one's presence there, not asking you questions, just presence there helpful, they can stay with you while you watch the comfort show so you don't feel alone. For me, very often, I just need my partners to leave when I'm having a meltdown because just seeing them gives me too much input. And that's something we've talked about after meltdowns before, where I've been like, hey, actually, I kind of needed you to get the fuck out of here. And I don't know how to say that without feeling like I'm mean. So we've come up with ways to say, hi, would it be more helpful if I stayed or if I left? They understand that me telling them I need them to leave doesn't mean I'm mad at them. It just means, yeah, I need the input to go away for now. Ultimately, your loved ones can help you by having a lot of conversations with you and just understanding this is not something that you really control, but you're doing your best to manage. And understanding that the thing that might help you one day might not be the same thing that helps you another day. And that how your meltdowns go is not a reflection of how well they're helping you. It's just part of the autistic experience for some of us. And for those of us that do experience meltdowns, it's really rough. I mean, the answer is not easy, but your loved ones can help you by having compassion and having a lot of conversations about meltdowns. But yeah, y'all, that's what I got about meltdowns. Since it is a solo dump, I am also just going to take care of the housekeeping section right now. Before I thank our Patreon supporters, I wanted to signal boost a mutual aid opportunity for those of you listening. I am boosting a Chuffed campaign for Wadi. Wadi lives in a tent with his family in Gaza with 7 other family members because their home was bombed and destroyed by the IOF. It currently costs Wadi hundreds of dollars for a bag of flour that isn't enough to feed his family for a week. Prices are continuing to rise rapidly and funds are more vital than ever. The aid sites that are set up are extremely dangerous and these funds help prevent him from having to go there. He was just injured at one of these sites last week. I'm going to have links to both the Chuffed campaign and the Funds for Wadi Instagram page, but Funds for Wadi on Instagram runs raffles regularly with items like art prints, herbal products, stickers, and they even have one coming up where you could enter a raffle for a keffiyeh and a book from a Palestinian author and other really cool goodies, honestly. So tickets for various raffles range from $1 to $10. Alternatively, you could go to the show details to find a link to Wadi's Chuffed campaign, and there you can make direct donations. I will have links to both the Funds for Wadi Instagram page and Wadi's Chuffed campaign in the show details. And now to thank our Patreon supporters, like Lilith Rain, Janice Weston, Anarchista, Bethany, Percy, Chamberlain Foreman, Nunya B, Kate Michigoose, K-Genius, Chibs1012, Dave Peril, Megan E, Carl Brooks, Natasha Neves, Gus Lutzi, Helen Clifford, B. Trossler, Sewing Seraph, Rachel Rachelson, Fintago, and Randy Lovings. Now, you know the huge, the best way, the absolute best way you can help us out is by telling other people about our shows. You could tell people about info dumpies. You could tell people about today's lucky winner. Maybe you know an autistic person who is newly recognized and could use just some general information because there's so much to absorb. Maybe you could send them some of the solo dumps. Maybe you know someone who has a special interest in something we've talked about in one of the previous regular episodes. Maybe you're in a group related to that special interest. Anywhere you can share the shows, it helps us. We don't take paid ads and we don't pay for advertisements, so word of mouth is entirely how we grow. And I cannot even describe to you how big of an impact it has when you share this show. Well, not just this show, but also today's lucky winner, when you share our shows with other people. It is truly the reason that I am able to spend so much time doing podcasting is because you all have shared so much. If you want to help us even more, you can subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. You can also leave a cute rating and or review if the platform that you're on supports those. More action in the algorithms gets us recommended to more people. It makes the show look very active, which is something that when people are looking for a podcast makes a difference. So if you can do that, it costs you nothing and it helps us quite a bit. If you are in a place to financially help us out, you can go to the show details to find a link to the Patreon page where the Mixnomer Patreon offers you bonus material for everything Mixnomer has done and is doing and is working on doing. We're working on two more audio dramas right now, so we got some good stuff cooking in there for you. But yeah, you can help us on the Patreon page. We do profit sharing with the cast and crew for everything. And we're constantly trying to upgrade people's equipment and software and stuff to make even better quality shows for everyone. If you want to come hang out with us, you can join the best Discord server in the world for the show details. The Mixnomer Discord server is a fun place where we do lots of streams and we try to do lots of community stuff. We're going to be doing like a seasonal garden club coming up, which I'm very excited about because it turns out a lot of us like gardening. We're doing an evening craft club. We do a Stitch and Bitch every Thursday. We have body doubling every Monday. We play weird video games. It's fun. I love our Discord server. But that's all I've got for you this time, my friends. Until next time, clever sign off.